Today is Thursday, June 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Who was responsible for a blast in Ethiopia's Tigray region that killed over 40 people?
Ethiopian government says they do not attack civilians.
Plus, Iran's human rights record is condemned by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
To date, there has been no accountability for any of the gross human rights violations.
And a look at Somalia's first female Taekwondo Olympian. These stories and more next. A bomb blast killed dozens of people Tuesday at a market in Ethiopia's Tigray region as new fighting flared up in areas outside the regional capital of Mekelle. The bomb went off in the town of Tagoga, west of Mekelle, at around 1 p.m. local time. There was conflicting reports on whether the blast was a result of a plane dropping a bomb or artillery shells hitting the market. Local media officials said that at least 43 people had been killed, with dozens of others being wounded. Earlier, I spoke with VOA's Heather Murdoch on Wednesday evening local time to get the latest.
The airstrikes that were reported came from witnesses and medical workers. So what we know basically is their reports that dozens of people were killed, dozens more were wounded. I also know from talking to some people in the Tigray region that the report that the road is closed is confirmed. So one of the problems with this attack was they couldn't get ambulances or patients to the main hospital in Mekelle, the capital city of the region. I also talked to some other people in a different city in Tigray that said there was other kinds of chaos in the region in the past couple of days that went unreported. In one city, a person I know told me that the city had been controlled by three different military groups in 2 days, and now everyone is at home and afraid to go out. Several houses have been destroyed, and three people were killed, according to my source in Tigray.
Do we know who is responsible for the airstrike? Has anyone taken responsibility for the action?
No, we don't know. The Ethiopian government says they do not attack civilians. But presumably the attack was meant to target fighters of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, which the Ethiopian government has declared a terrorist organization. But no one has come forward to say they actually conducted this attack.
One other question on Tigray. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed tweeted that there was no hunger in Tigray, but other aid agencies, as well as the United Nations, have reported widespread food insecurity. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain what we know about why the prime minister made such a statement.
There is a lot of talk in the capital that the reports of famine and the humanitarian crisis are exaggerated, and that the foreign media is biased against the government and exaggerating claims of humanitarian problems in the Tigray region. Why he would say there is no hunger as a statement like that, I'm not sure what that was supposed to mean. One colleague of mine told me that he thought, well, maybe he means that there's hunger in all sorts of regions of Ethiopia, and maybe his point was that Tigray is not more hungry than other areas. But the fact of the matter is there is hunger in Tigray. Even in the areas that are open to aid workers and journalists, there are shortages of food, and there are widespread reports of conditions near famine and about 350,000 people that are believed to be living with a famine right now.
I'd like to turn briefly to Addis Ababa and the capital where you are currently and talk about Monday's election. What can you tell us about how people are reacting to the electoral contest and what we can know about the process moving forward?
There's been a mixed reaction to the polling process. Some opposition figures have said that there are more than 200 irregularities that they counted, mostly things like missing ballots and missing poll workers, but also some reports of election monitors being intimidated or forced to leave their posts. There's also quite a bit of relief here in the capital that the election went by peacefully. The Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has a lot of support here, and a lot of the voters that we spoke to said that they believed it went peacefully and fairly, and they were just happy it was over. On the election day itself, the voting dragged on for a long time, so people were worried. At the time the polls were supposed to close at 6 o'clock, there were still hundreds of people in line at the one polling station I was. And throughout the night, we got reports of many polling stations with the same issue. And voting went on till 1 a.m. in the Capitol, and it continued the next day because many people, or most people, hadn't voted at all in some regions. So by Tuesday night, officials announced that almost every polling station that was open and that was conducting an election had concluded the vote and were starting to count the ballots. We should expect preliminary results in a few days, about 5 days from yesterday. But there is also to remember, a large portion of the population did not vote. There were several areas that postponed their vote till September because of security reasons, or also in some times logistical reasons. They didn't have ballots. The entire Tigray region is not voting at all. And there were two opposition parties in the region of Oromia who boycotted the vote.
That was VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. Ethiopia's elections mark the first test of voter support for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. He's Africa's youngest leader and the first in the country from the Oromia region. He's also backed by an expected majority in parliament. Many experts believe that by electing Abiy Ahmed, there may be regional implications, especially for the Horn of Africa and the Nile's downstream countries. Joseph Siegel is the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, and he explained these implications to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
There are many potentially important regional implications from these elections. That's a precedent for competitive elections. You know, the Greater Horn of Africa and East Africa more generally lag far behind Southern and West Africa in terms of the quality of democracy. So given the size of Ethiopia's population and its leadership role on the continent, to the extent that Ethiopia can make tangible progress in its democratic systems, it shifts the norms and expectations for elections elsewhere in the Greater Horn. You know, I think it's also highly significant that these elections offer the opportunity for more participation and representation in Ethiopia's most populous regions, something that we haven't seen under the minority-ruled EPRDF. And we could take that back further, that we really have not seen popular representation throughout Ethiopia's history. And so to the extent that Ethiopia can move in these directions, it's an important milestone for the region, especially with the complicated transitions we're observing in Sudan and Somalia. And so it may provide something of a guidepost for expectations and ways forward. I think the age factor is also notable. Africa is the world's youngest region. At the same time, it's typified by aging leaders who have stayed in power past their constitutionally mandated term limits. So the potential precedent that Abiy represents as a young elected leader is noteworthy.
Abiy Ahmed made the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam a national pride project, playing a vital role in the country's development, providing large amounts of hydropower. Egypt and Sudan said he showed no flexibility whatsoever in negotiations with them, even with U.S. mediation. If elections provided him with electoral mandate, political legitimacy, and consensus, how could that impact the already troubled negotiations with the downstream countries?
Over the past year, really since Ethiopia has begun filling the dam, Ethiopia has become increasingly reluctant to engage in negotiations with Egypt and Sudan over the management of the dam and the water flow. So it's hard to say what's going to happen following the election, especially if it provides electoral victory and greater legitimacy for Abiy. Historically, around the world and Africa, we've seen that democracies, countries that are more democratic, are more prone to mediation, and they have incentives to avoid conflict. Moreover, democracies tend to be more interconnected with the international system, and therefore they have incentives to maintain positive relationships with their key international partners. So to the extent that Abiy gains legitimacy and he has incentives to act more democratically and doesn't feel isolated internationally, I believe it's going to increase the likelihood that Ethiopia will resume negotiations in good faith, trying to reach some final agreements on the GERD.
How about the implication of his election regarding the border dispute with Sudan?
Well, I think the same pattern will hold if Abiy is increasingly seen as a democratically elected leader. Then he has incentives to maintain that reputation and to try and resolve differences through mediation rather than through conflict. And, you know, I think the leaders in Sudan have also shown a willingness to negotiate. And so I think this border conflict has always been something that is resolvable through negotiation. Neither side has a lot to gain by starting another conflict, given the other serious challenges they face. And so, I think to the extent that Abiy is seen as an increasingly legitimate leader, it increases the latitude he'll have to try to find a negotiated settlement.
That was the Africa Center for Strategic Studies Director of Research, Joseph Siegel, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll provides fresh evidence of a rift among Democrats and Republicans over U.S. policy towards Israelis and Palestinians. AP correspondent Julie Walker has the details.
The poll shows overall Americans are divided. It also shows more Americans disapprove of President Biden's approach to the conflict than approve of it. Among Democrats, 51% say the U.S. is not supportive enough of the Palestinians. The sentiment jumps to 62% among liberal Democrats. On the other hand, 49% of Republicans say the U.S. is not supportive enough of the Israelis. The number rises to 61% of conservative Republicans. I'm Julie Walker.
At least three people have died and more than 10 are injured in an explosion in Lahore, Pakistan, outside the house of Hafiz Saeed, a man linked to the 2008 Mumbai attacks that killed more than 170 people. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has that story.
The explosion outside the house of Hafiz Saeed was so strong it damaged nearby homes and several vehicles in nearby streets. Saeed is the leader of Jamaat-ud-Dawah, or JUD, an Islamist militant group operating in South Asia. It was not immediately clear if he was among the casualties. Security forces surrounded the area. Saeed's personal bodyguards were spotted around the house as well. Eyewitnesses and journalists were told to move away and cell phone signals were jammed. The head of police in Lahore, Ghulam Mehboob Dogar, said, so far, nothing is determined about the nature of the blast.
It could be a gas blast, could be something else, but somebody has to make a final determination as an expert's opinion.
Saeed is both on U.S. and U.N. lists of sanctioned individuals. Saeed's group is blamed for the 2008 attacks that killed more than 170 people in Mumbai, India. Last year, Pakistani courts convicted Saeed in several cases linked to terrorism financing. He's serving a sentence of 5.5 years. The U.S. has offered a bounty of $10 million to anyone providing information that leads to Saeed's conviction in the Mumbai attack. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
A new report by the United Nations Secretary General on the human rights situation in Iran condemns the widespread use of punitive measures and state-sponsored violence to keep the population in line. Michelle Bachelet, the World Body's High Commissioner for Human Rights, presented the report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The report finds Iran's slumping economy, deteriorating living standards, and increased social and political strains arising from the COVID-19 pandemic are fueling public discontent and protests. Despite these problems, the report says authorities show no willingness to adopt meaningful reforms or react compassionately to situations arising from this crisis. The Secretary General's report indicates the government is remaining firm and applying harsher punitive controls. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet notes, for example, that Iran continues the widespread use of the death penalty for acts that under international law do not constitute most serious crimes.
In violation of human rights law, death sentences are also frequently imposed based on forced confessions extracted through torture or after serious violations of the right to a fair trial. In 2020, at least 267 people, including 9 women, were executed. But only one of these executions were announced.
So far this year, she says at least 95 people have been executed, six of them women. She adds more than 80 children are on death row, with at least four at risk of imminent execution. The report notes ethnic, religious, and other minorities are at particular risk of abuse, forced disappearances, and executions. Bachelet says the report documents the inappropriate use of force by security agents against protesters and bystanders, as well as the intimidation, arbitrary detention, and criminal prosecution of human rights defenders, lawyers, and journalists.
To date, there has been no accountability for any of the gross human rights violations committed by security forces in response to protests. Persistent impunity for human rights violations remains a crucial concern.
Iran's UN ambassador in Geneva, Ismail Khamenei, dismisses the report, calling it politicized, prejudicial, and full of baseless allegations.
The report presented today is based on an entirely political mandate initiated by a group of like-minded, or rather, similarly biased countries that have for long instrumentalized human rights as part of their adversarial agenda against Iran.
The ambassador says Iran is committed to the promotion and protection of human rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Berlin for peace talks on Libya. He said Wednesday the talks present an opportunity to help bring lasting peace to the North African country.
The hope of this moment to actually see Libya hopefully take a course of security, freedom, independence backed by the international community.
Following the day's talks, Libya's foreign minister said progress had been made toward the removal of foreign fighters within the country. Since a 2011 NATO-backed uprising against then-leader Muammar Gaddafi, there has been little stability in the country other than a 2020 United Nations brokered ceasefire. A communique released after the conference said, in part, that more needs to be done to address and resolve the underlying causes of conflict, consolidate Libyan sovereignty, build on the progress made, and restore peace and prosperity for all Libyans. A 24-year-old Hong Kong man on Wednesday became the first defendant to be tried under the city's nearly one-year-old national security law. Tong Young Kit was arrested after he drove his motorbike into a group of police officers on July 1, 2020, the day after Beijing imposed the sweeping draconian law on the semi-autonomous city. The former restaurant cook was charged with terrorism and inciting secession for displaying a flag on his motorbike that read, "Liberate Hong Kong. Revolution of our times." Hong Kong's Justice Secretary has ordered Tong to be tried by a panel of three specially picked judges instead of facing an impartial jury, a move critics say erodes the independence of Hong Kong's judiciary. Tong has been held without bail since his arrest and entered a not guilty plea at the start of Wednesday's hearings. He faces life in prison if convicted. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong's sole remaining pro-democracy newspaper is publishing its last edition. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma takes it from here.
The Apple Daily has been forced to shut down after five editors and executives were arrested and millions of dollars in its assets were frozen as part of China's increasing crackdown on dissent. The board of directors of Next Media says in a statement the print and online editions will cease due to the current circumstances prevailing in Hong Kong. The Daily was founded by tycoon Jimmy Lai in 1995, just 2 years before Britain handed Hong Kong back to China, and initially was a tabloid known for its celebrity gossip. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The Delta COVID-19 variant, first identified in India, has spread quickly around the world and is now hitting India. Southeast Asia's largest country now looks at another peak as it hits the 2 million mark in confirmed cases. Aharyan Tama has more.
Hospital bed quickly fill up in this Indonesian capital. Jakarta is one of the three cities in this country that has seen a spike of new COVID-19 cases since the Muslim holiday Eid al-Fitri in mid-May. The spread of the Delta variant first detected in India is the likely cause.
beberapa daerah seperti
Kudus, some areas such as Kudus and DKI Jakarta, Jakarta and also in Bangkalan, it has been confirmed that the Delta variant or B.1.617.2 or also known as the variant from India dominates.
Varian dari India mendominasi.
Indonesia has reached 2 million total confirmed cases.
To help slow the spread,
President Joko Widodo wants to speed up vaccination to 1 million doses per day come July. But progress has been slow. The country is going to miss an earlier target of 70 million citizens vaccinated by July. Data from the COVID-19 task force from mid-June show fewer than 12 million people in Indonesia have been fully vaccinated. Among those 60 and older, fewer than 1 in 5 has been vaccinated, according to official data.
There are a few hurdles we're facing. First, not all elderly citizens are willing to be vaccinated. Turns out it's not easy to get them vaccinated. They may be worried about the side effects and comorbidities.
In June, the government made vaccination eligible for everyone 18 and older. A new target, 7.5 million people in Jakarta vaccinated by the end of August, which they say is enough to achieve herd immunity in the nation capital. For now, the nationwide restriction of public activities remain in place, but there's no plan for stricter lockdown orders like those in neighboring Malaysia.
PPKM Mikro,
micro-scale public activity restrictions are done to control COVID-19 at the roots of the problem, which is at the community level. This is more on target. But will this measure be enough? As reported by Reuters, two recent studies in Indonesia suggest the number of infected could be much higher than the official count. Lack of testing, which left cases undetected, may be to blame, says an epidemiologist who helped with the study.
Jadi kalau testingnya rendah ya.
If testing is low, result will be low. So we can compare the two. But it also indicates that our testing is insufficient in detecting transmission.
Testing kita memang belum mampu cukup banyak mengidentifikasi sebagian besar penularan.
Authorities forecast cases to peak before June is over. In the meantime, health experts are urging people to get the vaccine and urging the government to step up its testing and tracing program and to consider imposing stricter mobility restriction on its citizens. For Gita Permatasari in Jakarta, Ahadian Utama, VOA News.
New research shows that the AstraZeneca and Pfizer vaccines remain broadly effective against the Delta and Kappa variants of COVID-19. Reuters' Julian Satterthwaite has that part of the story.
Research by the University of Oxford looked into whether the shots generated antibodies that could neutralize the new variants. It concluded that they should still work, though it did find that the concentration of antibodies in the blood of vaccinated people was somewhat reduced. The researchers said that could lead to some breakthrough infections. Last week, an official analysis in the UK showed that the two shots provided 90% protection against hospitalisation with the Delta variant. The World Health Organization says it is now becoming the globally dominant version of the disease.
That was Reuters reporter Julian Satterthwaite. India's technology-driven vaccination initiative has raised concerns the country's huge digital divide is making it difficult for many people to get inoculated, particularly the nation's vast countryside. While tech-savvy, digitally aware city dwellers have managed to get shots, millions in rural areas are left behind because of a technology barrier. Anjana Pasricha has that story.
Those waiting at the center in North India's Kangra district could book a slot to get a COVID-19 vaccine because they had smartphones and knew how to register on the official website called Covin. Many others want the vaccine as a second wave of the pandemic ravaged the rural district, but they could not register as they do not have net connections or smartphones.
I have a simple phone. I don't even know how to operate the other phones.
Following criticism that the mandatory online process for those between the ages of 18 and 45 was excluding millions from India's inoculation drive in rural areas, the government has allowed everyone to walk in for appointments. But Manoj Sharma found that the tech-savvy still have the advantage. The numbers of those walking in are limited due to vaccine shortages, while shots are assured for those registering online. That is why Sharma is still desperately asking friends to book an online slot for him.
The government should facilitate this process for us. I am driving all day and providing an essential service.
The technology barrier prompts many to come to this facilitation center for help.
It's a problem because many people in villages are not very educated. Many don't possess smartphones and struggle with the online process.
Even rural residents with smartphones like Vivek Chand find it a challenge to get inoculated due to patchy internet connections. People in nearby towns grab the coveted vaccine slots faster.
Even if I register, I can't find a center close by to get a shot. Today, the only place where vaccines were available is miles away. Even those were restricted to those older than 45.
Such challenges have led to growing demands for administering jabs closer to villages, where two-thirds of Indians live.
Centers should be opened in each village for people to get vaccinated. This will remove all the hurdles they are facing.
Health experts say accessing the remote countryside should be a priority as vaccine shortages ease.
If you do not vaccinate them in adequate numbers, there will be a huge reservoir of susceptible persons which the virus or any new variant can attack. And ultimately, when in India's election, we managed to reach the ballot box to the remotest area, including the interior of forests, I think we ought to be able to find ways in which we can actually carry the vaccines there.
That is what these village residents want, an easily available shot to protect them from a third wave that doctors say will arrive. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
With the Olympics in Tokyo just a month away, Somalia is set to send its first female taekwondo athlete to the Games in Japan. Mohamed Kahir has this profile.
No athlete representing Somalia has ever won a medal at the Olympics. But 20-year-old Munira Warsame is working hard to be the first when she competes at 2021 Summer Games in Tokyo, Japan. The taekwondo athlete was born in Britain after her parents fled the violence in Somalia. Warsame says flying the flag of her home country in Japan will be a proud moment.
Feelings about representing my country in Olympics for the first time is unreal, as I've dreamed about this my whole life, since literally the age of six when I first started taekwondo. And also, it's such an exciting experience. And lastly, I feel so honoured to be representing my home country for my first ever Olympics, and inshallah, I do myself and my country proud.
According to Somali Olympics Committee, at least six athletes will represent the country in Tokyo in three categories: taekwondo, boxing, track and field. Taekwondo coach Rudley Ricardo says his team is very prepared despite financial challenges they encounter.
The potential of the Somali national team is looking quite bright and promising. I believe we have a small but strong current team with up-and-coming young team members. And inshallah, we'll be able to see much more results in future competitions. The only restraints we have is funding to allow the athletes valuable ring time at more competitions and training camps.
Taekwondo is not a well-known sport in Somalia, but the federation says it's conducting an awareness campaign in the country, especially in schools, to find more capable athletes like Munira who can represent their country in international competitions. Ahmed Issa is the vice president of Somali Taekwondo Federation.
Somali Taekwondo Federation are planning to recruit more youth to take sports, especially universities and colleges and schools. We try to do training sessions, free training sessions, and hire special coaches from international level. So people are really interested to be part of taekwondo sport.
More than 11,000 athletes from around the world are expected to participate in Tokyo Games, which were rescheduled from last year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.